listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Industrial Revolution created extraordinary economic growth for part of the world's population and led to enormous gaps in wealth and living standards between the industrialized countries and the rest of the world. In the last century, this trend reversed itself. The accelerated growth in the emerging nations has created a trajectory that is going to converge with that of the advanced countries and profoundly change the world. The challenge for the United States is to recover from the recent economic meltdown and shape continued growth in a way that accommodates our own interests as well as those of the global economy. Nobel Prize-winning economist Michael Spence has written a new book called The Next Convergence, and it explores the implications of the situation. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
On a lighter note, I just interviewed Albert Brooks, who's written a novel called 2030, and his vision involves a devastating earthquake in Los Angeles that destroys the city. The United States is bankrupt and can't afford to rebuild it, and we turn to the Chinese, who rebuild it for 50% ownership. Does that scenario sound reasonable to you?
Yes, it does, actually. I think it's a possibility. In fact, one of the things I think we need to do under the heading of up our game here in the United States is increase the investment rate and finance it from domestic savings, or we're going to be in a position where major countries that have excess savings are going to end up owning a lot of our assets.
Well, all we talk about these days is the deficit. Should that be our major concern?
Well, the deficit's important because if we let it get out of hand, then we'll destabilize the dollar, produce an interest rate spike. You know, there's lots of bad results. But there's another deficit, which is called the current account deficit. Most people think trade deficit, and they're very close. And that one's been running higher than it should be. An economy as rich as ours should be financing our investment and investing heavily in things that create productivity, growth, competitiveness, and employment.
But doesn't everybody talk about that, although they just seem to think the money should come from different places?
Yeah, the part that's missing, so the private sector investment that's domestic, we take our private sector, the corporate side. The multinationals are investing, but they're investing in other parts of the world where there's high growth and big market opportunities. They're not investing at home because there's no reason to. The demand is too low because our consumption went down after the debt-fueled asset bubble burst in 2008. So that's kind of our situation. What we would ideally do if we had a fiscal situation that allowed it is up the public sector investment in education, knowledge, technology, infrastructure, you know, getting ready for a higher cost energy world, et cetera, fix the tax system so it doesn't discourage investment and is simpler. That kind of thing would be a pro-growth, pro-employment agenda.
Well, this is all about growth, but you say that prior to the Industrial Revolution, it was basically a no-growth world. Mm-hmm. Hadn't it come a long way since the start of the Renaissance to the Industrial Revolution?
You know, the interesting thing is that there were some very important things happened in that period of time in mathematics and science, but they didn't turn into growth of any significant magnitude, as best the historians can tell, until the British Industrial Revolution.
But modern economic theory began with the Enlightenment, which predates the Industrial Revolution, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. You don't need modern economic theory to grow. You need entrepreneurs and technology and stuff like that. And it has to have a certain applied flavor to it. So, you know, the scientific revolution definitely preceded any economic revolution.
So we get the Industrial Revolution, and it changes parts of the world, mm-hmm. but not other parts.
Right.
Now, was it because certain places, we're talking about a European thing, or because certain countries understood that this was in their best interest at the time and others missed the boat?
I think, you know, it's complicated, but I think the single most important explanation is that most of the rest of the world was either disconnected or under colonial rule. And colonial rule had a set of asymmetries built in that basically didn't encourage the startup phase.
But let's take China. Yeah. China was not under colonial rule at the time.
No.
And it had a brilliant history and had been one of the leading producers of goods for much of the world's history. Mm. Why didn't the Industrial Revolution kick in there?
Well, first, we don't know the answer to why it kicked in the first time in one place rather than another. I mean, people think about that, but I don't think I have any particular insight into it. But that's different than joining the catch-up phase, which is what's driving the growth now. This thing didn't start spontaneous like a fire in multiple places. The modern growth in the post-World War II period is catch-up growth, imitating the and modifying the growth model, if you like.
Although the Japanese had done it earlier all on
their own. Japanese are an exception. So the Japanese was partly adopting Western technology and know-how after the opening up associated with the Meiji Restoration. That's right. And it's really the only part of the non-European and non-European offshoot world that did that.
But you just said that the pattern began to shift after World War II.
It did. The colonial empires essentially were dismantled. New countries were formed. They struggled with identity. And, you know, economists thought that the high-growth developing country area would be Africa and that the basket case would be Asia, as I said in the book. Of course, as is often true with economists, we were dead wrong.
And people kept on predicting that Brazil was going to become a major economic power. Well, they're predicting it again.
Well, they are. You know, they may be right. You know, Brazil is a very interesting case. You know, 13 countries have grown at what we called very high rates, 7% or above for 25 years or more. Brazil was the second after Japan, and it grew at those rates till the mid-1970s, about. And then it just stopped for about a quarter of a century. And now, starting in the mid-1990s...
Do we know
why? Well, we know pieces of it. They turned inward, you know, so they lost the sort of force of the global economy. They lost control. They created a dual economy, and they lost the ability to draw the portion of the economy that was in agriculture and relatively uneducated into the modern economy and so on.
They also became a totalitarian country for a while with military dictatorships. Yeah. Is there some kind of a link?
Well, that didn't help, although there are authoritarian countries in terms of governance that grow rapidly, obviously China being an example.
My guest is Michael Spence. His latest book is called The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. When the United States helped Germany and Japan rebuild after the war, didn't it allow them to leapfrog past certain American industrial giants like U.S. Steel?
Yes. Yeah. One of the advantages of coming late is that you can sort of skip over some of the sort of mature assets and put in newer technology, more efficient production facilities, and Germany and the war recovery in Europe and Japan had some of those characteristics.
And we wound up helping them, our ex-enemies, ruin our own industry to some degree, because we would have had to have stopped making steel the way we did, the old-fashioned way, do it in all sorts of new ways that would have probably have not been economically feasible.
No, that's true. We did, and we probably did the right thing. I mean, the experiment in punishing the vanquished after World War I produced disastrous results. But you know, even in business, I mean, people ask people like me all the time, why would a company like IBM cannibalize its own product line? And the answer is the Schumpeterian answer. If you don't do it to yourself, somebody else will do it to you.
Well, what about treaties, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade? What was that intended to do, GATT?
I think it was intended to open the global economy primarily for the advanced countries. And
didn't work.
Didn't work perfectly, but it started a process that led to opening up, and then there was a huge tailwind from technology, from, you know, communications, airplanes, ships, you know, now the internet and whatnot, and the combination of those two. And then, of course, it included the developing countries, although nobody really had any idea what role they were going to play.
Well, the Western economies had benefited from colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So was this an updated version?
No, I don't think so. I think colonialism was viewed as part of the past, and the uncertainty was nobody really knew whether the developing countries were actually going to grow and start this process of convergence or not.
What I meant was, for example, if we were just talking in terms of natural resources, Africa would probably be the richest of all the continents,
absolutely,
wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
But the Western economies have benefited from colonialism and post-colonialism in getting those natural resources and using them to their own benefit.
Yeah, but what changed, that's true. But what changed is we didn't tell them that that was their only function, and if they could use the revenues from the natural resources to invest in their own future, that would be fine with us.
Isn't a society defined by things other than growth, by its core values, its respect for individuals and rights? Is growth something that is exclusively the province of economists, or should we ignore those other things as we continue this discussion?
No, first of all, there's lots of things that people care about, you know, values, integrity, religious, spiritual things. And even in the broad area of material things, they you know, or things that relate to economics, they care about being productive, they care about contributing to society, they care about being creative, you know, in the context of an economic setting. The reason I focused on growth and the reason the Growth Commission that I chaired focused on growth is, you know, in a poor country, it's very hard to achieve these other objectives without a certain amount of material well-being.
And also a sense of cohesion. For example, in many of the countries where growth has been slow, they have been ethnically or tribally or even linguistically separate from each other within the same country.
Yeah. No, the new countries, you know, had a struggle to create a sense of national identity that enables this coming together to make present sacrifices for future gain, growth. And some of them have struggled with that for understandable reasons. I mean, I think the big miracle is India, that, you know, ethnically, religiously, linguistically diverse, the world's most complicated democracy in many ways, and yet here they are.
But the growth was fueled by the government, decisions by the government. When we go back to the early Industrial Revolution, the fantasy is that this all occurred separate from government policies. Is that true? Is that possible?
No. No, there's a parallel process of reform in all cases, including England. I mean, England was governed basically by the landed aristocracy, and that wouldn't work in the context of an industrial revolution, a growing middle class, and sort of the history of reforms in England, you know, in terms of governance are, you know, designed to support the evolving characteristics of the economy. And that happens over and over again.
And we're seeing that, of course, in China today and
yep.
in India. My guest is Michael Spence, who's a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and a former chairman of the Independent Commission on Growth and Development. He won the Nobel Prize in 2001, and he has written a new book called The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Michael Spence, whose latest book is The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And do I detect a Canadian accent there?
Yes. I was born in New Jersey and grew up in Canada.
Because there's so many economists come out of Canada. The Canadian economy doesn't strike me as being one of the driving forces of the world economy.
No, but Adam Smith was a Scot, and there's a lot of Scots lying around in Canada. Maybe that's the explanation.
In any economy, where does growth come from? Must there be some form of capitalism?
Well, the experiments so far in trying to do it another way have all failed, so it looks like we need a form of capitalism and the market system. Yes.
Well, what happened in the Soviet Union? Because it did grow.
Yeah, but it wasn't sustainable, and eventually it just fell of its own weight.
So after Mao died in China, there was a realization that they had to do something to create a sustainable economy. First went after agriculture, didn't they?
Yes, they did. There was 82% of the population in agriculture. They had quotas, which they had to fulfill. And what they did is experiment with telling people if they produced more than the quota, they could sell it in the open market, and the output exploded.
And they allowed people to own their own plots of land, which had not been allowed in the past.
That's right. They technically don't own it. The state still owns it, but they, for all practical purposes, they own it.
What about technological innovation? We have been relying in our country on that as the major driver of growth. Is that sustainable?
Yes. The advanced countries, once they've sort of deepened themselves in capital terms, basically grow because of what we've come to call technological innovation. And that Bob Solow taught us that, and it's still true.
But how do you manage technological innovation so that you can always keep the balance on the positive side?
Well, you can have environments in which the incentives are distorted and the rate of innovation is lower. I mean, the United States happens to be is structured in such a way that we're a very, very high innovation society. We have a strong parts of the educational system, an open flow back and forth between education and the business, entrepreneurial, venture capital section. So we perform well on that.
Although it's also been pointed out that we will come up with technological innovations, and then other countries, Japan, realize that that videotape could have a broader application other than just to be used by TV networks. We invent all sorts of things connected to the computers, and the manufacturing is done elsewhere.
Right.
Why can't we just keep it all at home?
Well, you know, part of the sort of innovation, knowledge spills over. It has this special property that, unlike most goods, when A gives it to B, then A and B both have it. And knowledge sort of transfer and knowledge spilling around the world is just an inherent part of the structure.
So if I'm a developing nation, I don't have to do anything. I can just simply see what's being done elsewhere and apply it.
Yeah, the high-speed growth is largely explained by the importation of knowledge that was created in the advanced countries.
But also, isn't high-speed growth a matter of proportion? If I have a dollar and somebody gives me $5, I've had a higher speed growth than if I have $1 million and somebody gives me $100,000.
Absolutely. I mean, people forget this, and it's an important point you make. You know, take China, for example. 20 years ago, China was growing at, 9%, and the increment to the global GDP was negligible. I mean, you could almost not feel it. Now China's still growing at 9%, and the increment's huge. And so the effect of sustained high growth is to make them big in size does matter.
In the end, they still don't have the standard of living of many Western countries like the Scandinavian countries, which seem to be doing very well, who don't have incredibly high growth.
No, well, advanced countries can't grow at these high rates. I mean, we can't. We do it by technological progress. And the maximum sustained growth in advanced countries is 2.5%.
Hasn't most of the conversation in industrialized countries about how to promote growth in developing countries centered on foreign aid?
Yeah, I think that's a mistake, actually. It has.
And why doesn't that work? If you give a country money to help develop its industry, shouldn't that work? I mean, it did work with Japan and Germany after the war, didn't it?
So think of it this way. Suppose you have a machine that has five broken parts, and you give somebody one part that it would actually work, but the other four parts are still broken. Then the machine doesn't run. And I think the mistake in focusing on aid is not that under the right circumstances it can't do some good in enhancing a country's ability to invest, but if the other pieces are not in place, the openness, the willingness to invest at high rates, the inclusiveness and the other features that I try to talk about, then the aid just sort of lands and then somebody steals it.
Well, how does China do it then? Because it doesn't have a lot of openness. It controls the flow of information.
No, I mean openness in the economic sense.
Uh-huh. So they allow for total openness in the economic sense, but nowhere else?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it total openness, but there's a very sharp distinction between sort of the way I like to think of it is, you know, democracy as we see it has two important dimensions. One is a dimension having to do with individual freedom, which includes kind of economic freedom, freedom to do what you want in the economic zone subject to minimal constraints. And the other one is having a voice in the collective choices that we make. In China, you have the economic freedom largely, and you have virtually no voice, you know, in the sense we mean in a democracy.
But education has changed. China, after the Cultural Revolution, where the colleges were closed,
right,
and a whole generation kind of was lost,
right,
now they're going through the same sort of thing as starting industrialization from scratch, aren't they? And education is a key to growth.
Yeah, they didn't, you know, it was very damaging. There's no question. They lost a generation. And so, you know, when you visit a university and give a lecture now in China, you know, the faculty looks like sort of the older group like me and a younger group. It's quite funny, and there's a kind of missing, or used to be. They will overcome this. The thing that China did right in education, and better than any other developing country, is they got the literacy rates up to 90% for both men and women, and they did it before the reforms. That was under the Mao era.
But isn't it expensive to disseminate knowledge in an emerging economy?
Well, it's not costless, but it's a lot cheaper than inventing it yourself.
Other than changing agricultural policy, what are some of the other things that Deng Xiaoping and his group of reformers in China did in order to change the direction in the 1970s?
Well, they allowed the market system to work broadly, and then they opened the economy up to the rest of the world.
Despite the fact that they still call themselves a communist state.
Yes. And people are still confused about that. I get asked the question, you know, how can a planned economy grow this fast? And the confusion is caused by the fact they still have five-year plans, but they're not plans in the same sense they used to be.
I've had guests on the show who have suggested that an authoritarian government is actually more conducive to economic growth. We see it in Singapore. We see it in China. I probably can come up with a couple of other examples.
I have a slightly different view. So if you look at the high growth cases, that what we would call economic successes, you see democracies, single party, dominant single parties evolving into multi-party democracies, as in Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And then you see autocratic systems whose evolution we don't know yet. And then if you look at poor performers, you see the same thing. Democracies that have developed pathologies that cause them to fail, and autocratic systems that are disasters. So my conclusion from this, since you can fill in all the boxes, is that it isn't the form of governance that's decisive, actually. It's values and intent. So governments that are operating in the interests of a small group or their own enrichment fail economically to produce growth and progress, and the ones that appear to be acting or trying to act in the interests of the vast majority of the people, a subset succeed.
My guest is Michael Spence, whose latest book is The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World, published by Farris, Strauss, and Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are the relaxed attitudes towards intellectual property in places like China and India a result of the knowledge transfer we've been talking about?
Possibly, but they tend to. This problem tends to occur in poorer countries because, you know, it's an affordability question, and it tends to go away as they generate their own knowledge and technology and have a reason to protect it and the resources, the legal and other resources to do it.
So we are eventually going to see China and India enact new laws, although not for the time being.
Yep.
What do you mean by the categories of tradable and non-tradable goods and services in the global economy?
Tradable goods and services are goods that are services that can be produced in one country and consumed in a different one.
Mm-hmm. But you say that countries produce what they're good at. Aren't there some developing countries whose output in every sector compares unfavorably to that of other countries?
Yeah, so this turns out to be the hardest concept in economics. It's called comparative advantage.
That's why I waited to get to it.
So you can have an absolute disadvantage in everything, but but you will have a comparative advantage in the things that you have the least disadvantage in. And the way this actually happens in the world, the reason you can trade in the ones where you have a comparative advantage, even though you may have a huge absolute disadvantage, is the exchange rate adjusts until you're competitive.
Well, the Japanese had very few natural resources.
Yep.
And yet they, for a while, I don't want to get into what happened there, but for a while they became one of the major economic powers in the world. And that's because they were good at making things, even if they didn't really have much to make it with?
Yes. I mean,
they were able to buy cheap and sell at a profit?
The thing that Japanese probably realized first in the developing world, it's a hybrid case because, as you pointed out, it developed early and then the war and then developed again. The thing that Japan realized and the Asians realized, because they're resource poor relative to, say, Africa, is their major resource was human beings and their productive potential, their ability to innovate, their ability to generate value. And so they invested in that. They may not have known if they were right, but it turned out to be right. That is the enduring basis of the creation of value.
Isn't one of the problems of a global market that the comparative advantage is not static, and that as a country develops, it is difficult to maintain?
Yes, it is. So this is the hard thing about growth and development in the developing world. So take China. China's at the middle income transition. The per capita income is about $4,000. Doesn't seem very high compared to ours, which is $47,000. But it's high enough to put them out of business in the labor-intensive process manufacturing sectors. And so their economy is going to have to structurally change to create the employment in higher value-added activities to support these rising incomes. This all happens, you know, endogenously all at the same time. And sometimes countries resist this or trip or stall out in making these structural transformations.
Is there always a tipping point? Has there ever been a time when it just kept on going up and up and up?
Yes. The high growth economies that sustained it really all the way through to almost advanced country incomes were Japan, stalled out later, but for different reasons. Korea, Taiwan, and the city-states Hong Kong and Singapore. Everybody else slowed down.
What do personal levels of savings have to do with economic growth? Because we always hear about one of the biggest problems in this country is that pretty much everyone is in debt, and countries like Japan were often lauded for having really high levels of savings.
Yeah, so the critical thing for growth is high levels of investment. You're a lot safer, and you own more of the assets if you have a comparably high savings rate. And if you borrow too much from foreigners, especially if you borrow in their currency, there's lots of accidents that can happen, and we've seen them, basically, over the years. Borrowing in somebody else's currency is a very particularly bad idea.
And there are still fights all the time about exchange rates, and that really is a major factor. Is that the same thing as setting up tariffs, ultimately?
Well, in terms of protecting, no, it's not actually.
Because it does protect your, if you keep an exchange rate relatively low, isn't that the equivalent of?
No. It'll protect an industry. But, you know, if you need structurally change to grow and you hold down the exchange rate and protect them, you'll actually kill the growth engine by stopping the structural change. So this, I think, is something that people don't understand. So China manages the exchange rate the way – slightly differently, but as most developing countries do – to control the rate of change of the terms of trade and the structural evolution to keep them in balance. If you go too fast – the structural evolution and employment engine can't keep up. If you go too slowly, then you just keep making labor-intensive stuff. And there, you know, the way you know that won't work is look around and see if you can find an advanced economy with those industries present, and you won't find one.
Another problem is that we talk a free trade game, and then everybody sees through it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Protectionism all over the world, isn't there?
Yes, there is, and so I think we do talk the game as if it were a sort of economic religion. In fact, none of us practice it. The United States, when we were faced with severe competition from Japanese automobile imports, we had for a while quotas on Japanese imports. We took them off. It wasn't terribly damaging. Probably helped keep some of the industry here, although foreigners owned the plants. But so I think the practical reality is that we live in a mixed system.
Well, in our system, there are politicians who say that if we keep taxes low, especially for the wealthy, that's going to create jobs and that's going to inspire growth. Taxes have been low. Growth has not really followed. If anything, is this this widening economic gap between the wealthy and the poor in this country causing more of a problem for growth than encouraging it?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on, and this is a subject of active research now, and I think we're all paying attention. But I think the emerging markets are now big enough to have and rich enough, meaning up the value-added chain, to have impacts on us that they did not have, say, 25 years ago, and we need to pay attention to it. My own guess, based on the research I've done, is that this is adversely affecting mainly the middle income range in America by lowering the employment opportunities in the tradable sector as those things move offshore. You can make this story more complicated, but I think that accounts for a part of the current employment problem and the longer-term income distribution problem, adverse distribution problem that we've had for 20 years.
Is it possible for us to restore fiscal balance without damaging the recovery and future growth?
That's a good question. I think there is no short...
Because people are debating that right now.
I know. I don't... My personal opinion is there is no short-run fix. You know, it's going to take time and investment to restore enough competitiveness to get the growth and the employment engines restarted at a level that's acceptable to our fellow citizens. And it's harder to do that with a fiscal challenge of this type.
Michael Spence is a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former chairman of the Independent Commission on Growth and Development, and the recipient of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. His latest book, The Next Convergence, The Future of Economic Growth in a Multi-Speed World, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.